The House comes for oral questions. Question number one is the Nauma Kuretapu Allen.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy in the context of the global COVID-19 pandemic?
Mr Speaker.
Honourable Grant Robertson.
Today, Statistics New Zealand released its latest data on employment indicators for the June 2020 quarter. The data showed that the economy continued to add jobs in June, following a strong rebound in May when most lockdown restrictions had begun to ease. The number of filled jobs rose by 2,053 in June, building on the 14,399 rise in May. Although this only partly reverses the drop seen during the lockdown in April, filled jobs remain above where they were at the same time last year. Mr Speaker, we all know that the road ahead for many will be tough, but this is an encouraging sign of the economy bouncing back from lockdown, with Kiwi businesses and workers now seeing the benefits of our decision to go hard and early to control COVID-19.
Supplementary, sir. What reports has he seen on the performance of New Zealand's exports?
Mr Speaker, on Friday, Statistics New Zealand released overseas merchandise trade statistics for June 2020. These showed total exports were up from the same time last year. Goods exports in June were worth $5.1 billion, up $107 million from June 2019. The rise was led by dairy, with milk powder, butter and cheese up $90 million, or 7.9%. The value of log exports was also up by 7% since June 2019. This strong performance from our exporters contributed to a monthly trade surplus of $426 million in June. The trade deficit for the year ending June was $1.2 billion, the smallest annual trade deficit since December 2014. Mr Speaker, all of this effort by our exporters demonstrates the continued strength of that part of our economy, despite the difficult prevailing conditions arising from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Supplementary, sir. What reports has he seen on the place of the housing market in New Zealand's economic recovery from COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, I've seen Reserve Bank figures released on Friday which show that first home buyers took a bigger share of new mortgages than property investors in June for the first time since 2013, when this series began. First home buyers committed to $1.1 billion in home loans last month, taking on 20% of all new mortgages, while loans to investors dropped to $1 billion, or 19.4% of new mortgages. Mr Speaker, this government continues to be focused on ensuring more affordable housing is available. While growth in the housing market cannot be at the centre of any economic plan, after years of struggling to get a look in, it's good to see first home buyers finally getting a fair go. Yeah.
Question number two, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by her statement in the House on 22 July, quote, on 1 April we created the Infrastructure Reference Group, on 17 May we received over 1,900 potential projects. That was then provided to ministers. We worked through a short list of 800. On 29 June, very quickly, they were signed off, and on 1 July, they started to be rolled out, end quote. If so, why hasn't her government released the full list of projects?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes. I note my very next sentence after the quote the member used provides the answer to the second part of her question. Quote, we've already had hundreds of millions of dollars worth announced. Some we continue with due diligence, but we are moving as swiftly as we can, end quote.
If these projects have been signed off, why has the construction sector not been informed of the full list of projects?
Mr Speaker, as I have just said, where there are projects that we have not yet announced publicly, that is because we are still in some cases undertaking due diligence. In some cases that will mean that applicants have been advised of the outcome. But I'm not willing to compromise the Crown's negotiating position as we work through some of those projects. And equally, I'm not willing, just to satisfy the member, preemptively announce projects when we owe it to, of course, taxpayers to go through a process properly. I think, Mr Speaker, on this we've got the balance right.
If, as the Prime Minister says, she's protecting the Crown's negotiating position and there's still due diligence being made, then why did she announce that they were signed off?
Mr Speaker, because, of course, we wouldn't want officials going into a process negotiating a project that we haven't had ministers agree to.
How was the government able to issue a press release detailing how much funding was allocated for projects by region and an estimate of jobs if the government had not confirmed the details of these shovel-ready projects?
Mr Speaker, because in-principle decisions were made and then that gave the mandate to officials to go into the negotiating position or to finalise details of those individual projects. Mr Speaker, again though, despite that, the speed of which we have been moving on this area, I think means that we should be congratulating Crown Infrastructure Partners, PDU, those who have predominantly been involved in moving very, very quickly to strike that balance between investing in infrastructure in our local communities, but also doing it in a very managed way. We would not be making this more than $2 billion investment in these projects were it not for COVID-19, but the fact that they have enabled us to respond so quickly and communities have benefited from that, I think deserves congratulations to them.
How is it possible to issue a press release detailing exactly how much funding was allocated for projects by region if, as the Prime Minister has said, those projects still and the prices of them still need to be negotiated?
Speaker, for the same reason that of a $3 billion contingency, we put aside $2.6 into infrastructure projects but allowed a $400 million contingency, we have been able to create brackets of funding to demonstrate where that likely investment is going to go, but we still have needed to complete due diligence. I remind the member, actually last week in the House when she asked me the same question, at that point we had announced funding of roughly $750 million and at that time I believe it was 50 projects had been announced. Now we're over halfway there with announcements and spending of over $1 billion. So if the member wishes to ask me again, I'm sure I'll have another update for her in the House next week again.
Why is the government drip-feeding projects via ministerial visit and press release instead of releasing the full list of projects and delivering certainty for the construction sector, as her Deputy Prime Minister has confirmed last week in the Wellington Chamber of Commerce?
Mr Speaker, obviously I would not characterise the process and the due diligence we are going through in the cynical way that the member has. I would remind the member we would not be making these announcements were it not for COVID-19. That it's my expectation that the vast majority will likely be announced by the time this House rises or shared directly with applicants by the time this House rises. I would be very surprised if that member's list of the $80 billion worth of cuts she intends to make will be announced by then.
Well, then, if the Prime Minister is going to accuse me of being cynical on this, was her Deputy Prime Minister also cynical last week when he said that the list of shovel-ready projects should be released?
Mr Speaker, again, I have worked through the timing of what we are doing and the process of what we are doing. I remind the member that the point I was making is that these projects exist because of COVID, no other reason.
Somebody question.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
So I can ask the Prime Minister, is the process that ministers look at the projects, the PDU does the serious hard work, they put together the fiscals, and then it goes to tender, and if there's a successful one, we're off and running, and that's what the Deputy Prime Minister was saying.
Mr Speaker, obviously the Deputy Prime Minister would be well placed to give the context of that statement. But Mr Speaker, I stand by the process that we as a government are going through with these projects and the speed at which we are moving, which given the scale of what we are trying to do, but also the impact on communities, I think we are to commend the public service for the work that's been done.
Were the projects she announced in Taranaki on Thursday signed off by Cabinet on the 29th of June? And if so, why did it take a month for them to be announced?
Speaker, as I have mentioned a number of times, once the in-principle decision has been made by ministers, there is still additional detail to go through. The reception that I received and heard from those on the ground in Taranaki demonstrated to me that they were very pleased with the process that they had gone through, that they felt engaged in the process, and that the community would benefit from the outcome.
That process also include when the Prime Minister would be in Taranaki to make those announcements.
Mr. Speaker, again, I reiterate, these projects only exist because of COVID. Now, the member and her party either supports infrastructure investment or will continue to claim that this is political when it is not.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he agree with the opinion of Marama Davidson that tax is love?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
That's not a phrase I am using. For me, tax is what we all pay to ensure a fair society where we look after each other, or in the words of Jerry Brownlee, quote, tax is something that people contribute in order to have the sort of society that they live in.
So is
always go for wise words.
So I'm going to ignore that and we'll start again.
Supplementary. So is tax not love?
Mr. Speaker, as I've already said, for me, tax is what we all pay to make sure that there is a fair society where we look after each other.
And why does it do it to me? I don't know. Supplementary. Does he think that Kiwis would feel the love if the government continues to take more money from their pockets?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I think what New Zealanders feel is this is a government that's looking after them. In fact, to coin a phrase, love is all around.
Does he anticipate that some New Zealanders will have to pay tax at higher rates or new taxes in the next 3 years if he remains Minister of Finance?
Mr. Speaker, I'm responsible as Minister of Finance for this government's policy, and we've been very clear that we aren't increasing tax rates. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, over the last 3 or 4 months, we've done a number of things that have used the tax system to help put money back into the pockets of New Zealanders.
David Seymour.
Does the Minister believe that the next generation of taxpayers will love paying back the $140 billion of borrowing forecast at budget time?
Mr. Speaker, I think all New Zealanders would recognise that when you're faced with a one in 100 year shock to the New Zealand economy, it's important that the hard work done by a number of governments to put us in a position to be able to borrow money and to be able to use that to protect the lives and livelihoods of New Zealanders is the best thing to do.
When does he forecast the government will get back into surplus and start lovingly repaying the debt that he has borrowed?
Mr. Speaker, the budget that we released in May indicated it would take us around about 8 years to do that. The Treasury will... the Treasury will no doubt update their forecasts in the pre-election fiscal update.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Would New Zealanders have to pay significantly higher taxes or experience significant cuts to public services in order to meet alternative debt reduction targets that are being proposed by some?
Well, Mr. Speaker, absolutely. I mean, the bottom line here is whatever we do, whether it is spend money or whether we try to reduce debt, that actually has to be paid for. I've seen a proposal to see us try to get back down to 30% net debt within a decade. That would require $80 billion worth of cuts. People who propose that need to explain where that's coming from.
Supplementary. So is it his view that it's always a simple choice between public sector cuts and higher taxes?
Mr. Speaker, absolutely not. And in fact, as this government has shown, we've managed to keep tax rates relatively stable after we got rid of the unfair tax cuts that the National Party had proposed, and we've managed to spend more money on public services. We can walk and chew gum, Mr. Goldsmith.
Will he rule out introducing newer higher thresholds for income tax in the next 3 years if he remains Minister of Finance?
I thank the member for his confidence in the re-election of this side of the House into government. I am responsible for the tax policy of this government.
Now,
hiding.
Given up already.
Order. Question number four, the Honourable James Shaw.
And my question is to the Minister of Housing. What recent announcements has she made about the government's progressive home ownership scheme?
Mr. Speaker.
Dr. Megan Woods.
On Friday, I announced the first phase of the government's $400 million Progressive Home Ownership Fund, which will enable up to 4,000 families who could not otherwise afford home ownership to get into their own homes. This government inherited a housing crisis with an increasing number of New Zealanders locked out of home ownership, and we're committed to turning things around. One provider in Auckland and another in Queenstown are the first two partners selected due to the severe affordability issues in those cities, and more providers will follow. The Progressive Home Ownership Fund is yet another step forward in this government's plan to address housing affordability.
How will Māori benefit from this program?
Mr. Speaker, the Progressive Home Ownership Program has a dedicated iwi and Māori pathway with a specific focus on providing more secure, healthy housing for Māori. We know that the gap that's been created between house prices and what is affordable disproportionately affects Māori. This program will help these families by sharing the cost of a mortgage and addressing the deposit barrier to getting their own home. The fund will also scale up funding for organisations already providing progressive home ownership schemes with wraparound support services such as budgeting advice.
How many families will be supported into home ownership and how quickly?
Mr. Speaker, the first tranche of funding will support 100 families into home ownership, and I expect the first of these families to have their own home by November this year. Phase one is providing us with a good opportunity to learn what is required to deliver a fully effective fund so we can streamline the systems and the processes as needed and ensure we target the priority groups the fund intends to assist. Ultimately, this investment will help up to 4,000 New Zealand families buy their own homes.
Well done. And how does progressive home ownership fit in with the rest of the government's housing program?
Mr. Speaker, this government is proud of its investment and commitment to boarding affordable housing for New Zealanders, and this is yet another milestone in the government's broader housing program. In addition to getting families in homes they may otherwise be unable to afford, this will also provide confidence to the construction sector and create jobs for Kiwis. This is a government that has ramped up its public house builds to levels not seen in decades. We have also committed to providing warmer, healthier and high-quality homes for New Zealanders to live in. I stand by our record of getting to work and addressing the crisis we inherited 3 years ago.
Question number five, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Housing and ask, does she plan to introduce and pass legislation before the House rises on the 6th of August to allow for people returning from overseas to be charged part of the costs of undertaking managed isolation?
Mr. Speaker, as the member is aware, the government has been considering this for a number of weeks now and extensive work has been ongoing. As I have stated publicly, this is a complex area and we have to carefully and methodically work through all the implications. The work is almost complete and I'm happy to inform the member that we'll be making an announcement very, very shortly.
Mr. Speaker, what is the policy detail the Prime Minister said yesterday was being finalised ahead of an announcement?
The member will need to wait and see.
Well, does she hope to announce the detail of the charging regime ahead of the election?
As I informed the member in the answer to my primary answer, that the announcement is very, very soon.
Does she accept that there is some urgency around implementing a charging regime, given that managed isolation is currently costing taxpayers around $10 million a week?
Mr. Speaker, this is a government that is well aware of all the different factors that go into managed isolation, one of those being what an important line of defence the proper operation of our managed isolation and quarantine facilities have been in our fight against COVID. I know that member is a member of a party that is playing fast and loose with the border, but Mr. Speaker, we are a party committed to maintaining a strong line of defence.
A point of order, the Honourable Jerry Browning.
Mr Speaker, that is a completely unreasonable thing for the Minister to say in an answer. After all, we're not the government, we're
order,
not controlling
order,
the border.
Order, order. The member can't get up and say he doesn't like an answer. The member, if the member said that, which I missed, he will withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise. Point of order.
A point of order. The Honourable Jerry Browning.
Mr Speaker, I said it was unreasonable for a minister to make an accusation like that in an answer.
Exactly.
And I think it is.
Well,
we don't control the border. They do.
Does the member have a further supplementary?
Yes, it is. Is the real problem of not getting a charging regime in place prior to the election that she's been unable to convince all partners in the government coalition to agree to it? And if that is the case, will she reach across the aisle where there is a clear understanding of what needs to be done?
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, no. And in answer to the second part of the question, we always welcome the opposition supporting the wonderful legislation that this government may put up.
No more. Question number six, Dr Duncan Webb.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Energy and Resources. What recent announcements has she made about the government's target of 100% renewable electricity?
The Honourable Dr Megan Woods.
Thank you. On Sunday, I announced the government has taken another step forward on our pathway to 100% renewable electricity. We've set aside $30 million to commence work on what could be the largest single infrastructure project since the 1980s. The initial phase of this project will be a detailed development of a business case focused primarily on pumped hydro storage, a key recommendation of the Interim Climate Change Committee. If the business case stacks up, a pumped hydro scheme could deliver significant benefits for New Zealand, including the widespread electrification of transport and industry, thousands of jobs and more affordable power for New Zealanders in the long run. If the project proceeds, it will see us become one of the few countries in the world with 100% renewable electricity and enable the widespread decarbonisation of our economy.
How could this project deliver cheaper power in the long run for New Zealanders?
Mr Speaker, what we know is that renewable sources of generation are a lower cost than generation by fossil fuels, but they don't provide reliable round-the-clock supply, and therefore our system is currently reliant on expensive fossil fuels when the wind isn't blowing and the hydro lakes are low. A pumped hydro scheme works like a battery, where renewable energy is stored in an upper reservoir and is released back down into a hydropower station to generate electricity when demand is high. It is then pumped back up to the reservoir when demand is low and prices are low. This would drive down prices for consumers by removing the reliance on fossil fuels in the system and support more renewable energy generation.
What response has she seen to the government's announcement?
Short.
Okay. it's hard to keep this one short, Mr Speaker, but I'll try. The response to the announcement has been overwhelmingly positive. Vector Chief Executive Simon McKenzie welcomed the announcement, saying pumped hydro would provide a smooth and reliable transition to a 100% renewable system as fossil fuel generation plants are retired. And Greenpeace Chief Executive Russell Norman has also welcomed the news, suggesting pumped hydro would have massive climate benefits for New Zealand.
Question number seven, Dr Shane Reddy.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Health, which public hospitals have staff that are also employed in isolation facilities, and what is the impact of staff moonlighting?
Oh, there is another business.
Mr Speaker, district health boards that have managed isolation and quarantine facilities in their region include Canterbury, Lakes, Auckland Metro, including Waitemata, Counties Manukau and Auckland, Waikato and Capital and Coast. They manage medical staff across hospitals and other facilities as is required. These services are currently provided in MIQ facilities by contractors. From Saturday, district health boards will take over the delivery of health services in managed isolation and quarantine facilities. I expect DHBs to employ dedicated workforces for those facilities, even if they rotate in and out for periods of time. At my request, independent experts are currently auditing managed isolation and quarantine facilities, infection prevention and control against nationally developed standards. After that work has been completed, ongoing monitoring will be undertaken by Health Cert. I'm advised by the Ministry of Health that they are not aware of any circumstances in which medical procedures have been cancelled or delayed due to hospital staff also working in secondary employment.
Supplementary. How many staff and DHBs are also currently employed in isolation facilities?
Mr Speaker, I do not have those numbers. As I've been very clear, they are a contracted workforce.
Supplementary. Has he read the incident review report on COVID-19 staff infections at Waitakere Hospital, and have staff at Waitakere Hospital also been employed in isolation facilities?
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, I haven't read the report myself, but I have been advised that the findings from that report have been used as the basis for tightening up the infection prevention and control that is done across the board with regard to responding to COVID-19 cases.
Supplementary. How can he state, as reported, that it is safe for DHB staff to also work in isolation facilities when his office wrote last week that PPE is not a requirement for staff in managed isolation at all times?
Mr Speaker, I'd have to check the second part of the member's question, but with regard to the first part of the member's question, I do trust the staff who are working in all aspects of the response to COVID-19 to follow the professional standards that they would normally adhere to. So I do have faith that nurses who are trained in both the use of PPE but also in infection prevention and control will be following best practice.
Supplementary. Has there been any impact on DHB services due to staff also working in isolation facilities?
Mr Speaker, I'm aware that there has been an impact on Capital and Coast, because staff at Capital and Coast spent some time in the last 24 hours investigating whether or not the claim that significant proportions of their theatre workforce had been on sick leave because of their moonlighting was correct, and they found that that claim was not correct. So the biggest impact on their workforce was following up false claims being made by the National Party once again.
Question number 8, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, what proportion of the working age population is receiving the COVID-19 wage subsidy, COVID-19 income relief payment or job seeker support?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr Speaker, an estimated 6.3% of the New Zealand working age population were receiving job seeker support, and an estimated 0.3% were receiving the COVID-19 income relief payment as at the end of June 2020. Can I just say, with regards to the COVID-19 income relief payment, it is not only those who are deemed of working age population that can access it, like with benefit. It does extend beyond the 18 to 64 category, so it does take a little bit longer to pull together that information, hence why I've used the end of June 2020 information. The wage subsidy is paid to the employer, and MSD reports on the number of jobs associated with the subsidy. I can advise that the wage subsidy has supported 1.7 million jobs. These initiatives are examples of how the government is responding to the needs of people, families and communities in supporting the long-term economic recovery for New Zealand.
Supplementary. What is the total number of people that are currently being supported by the COVID-19 wage subsidy, COVID-19 income relief payment or job seeker support?
Mr Speaker, so the figures that I used earlier for end of June were because we had to work out the working age population, and as I said, with COVID, the COVID job loss cover, they can access that from 16 to over 65, actually, if they'd been working. So the most recent numbers for the COVID job loss cover at the end of last week was about 18,500. Those on main benefit currently is at about 352,000. And as I said, the number of jobs that have been supported through the wage subsidy is currently at around 1.7 million.
Is she confident that the 436,922 Kiwis who are currently receiving the wage subsidy will continue to have a job when the subsidy ends? And if yes, why?
Mr. Speaker, we put the wage subsidy in place to provide some support for businesses so we could provide some certainty for those that do currently have jobs. And Mr. Speaker, we're hoping that as many of those businesses are able to survive this unprecedented event as possible. But we certainly can't put a number on that. And we do know, and we've always said, that unfortunately the reality for us as a country and the reality globally is that there will be job losses. We just want to see as few of those as possible. And I think it is heartening that the New Zealand economy is continuing to perform better than expected by most economists.
Is the current number of people on temporary income support, which is 455,514, showing that Treasury's forecast of 300,000 people who will be unemployed too high, too low, or about right?
Mr. Speaker, unemployment is actually, at this point, expected to peak slightly lower than previous forecasts. However, the pre-election economic and fiscal update will include the next official government figures. Mr. Speaker, we are in uncertain times, and this government has put every measure into place that we can to mitigate the risk of job losses, and we continue to invest in not just the creation of jobs but opportunities for upskilling and training to ensure that we are looking after New Zealanders during this really difficult period.
Is she aware that the number of Kiwis currently receiving the wage subsidy and income relief payment is almost equal to the amount of people living in the Waikato region? And if so, what is the plan to get Kiwis back to work?
Mr. Speaker, we're not going to apologise for providing New Zealanders with financial support during this very difficult time. And Mr. Speaker, we put the wage subsidy in place for that purpose. We put the job loss cover in place for that purpose. We bolstered the support that we can offer through the Ministry of Social Development, not just with respect to income, but also with respect to supporting people to get into work. What is heartening, Mr. Speaker, can I say, is that actually in June we had more exits off benefit into work this year than what we did last year. I think it was around 7,500 exits off benefit into work as opposed to 5,200 the same time last year. So I think this government has shown itself to be very proactive and focused on what is most important, and that is New Zealanders during this time.
Question number 9, Jan Tinetti.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Education, what response has he seen to the government's initiative to encourage vocational training and apprenticeship during New Zealand's recovery from the impact of COVID-19?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, I've seen a report on the government's targeted training and apprenticeships fund, which abolishes fees for those in areas of training that will give them better employment prospects. The report estimates that as a result of the policy, about 5,000 Kiwis are now studying qualifications in more than 130 subjects, providing what the report calls a huge boost for the tertiary sector. This includes just over 2,000 extra enrolments at the Open Polytech, 730 at the Wellington Institute of Technology, nearly 500 at the Monaco Institute of Technology, over 300 at the Western Institute of Technology and the Universal College of Learning, and about 100 at the Nelson Marlborough Institute of Technology.
What response to the Targeted Training and Apprenticeship Fund has he seen in relation to Otago Polytechnic?
Mr. Speaker, vocational enrolments at Otago Polytech are reportedly up by more than 400 compared to the same time last year. As the Chief Executive has said, this equates to them being almost 7% above budgeted numbers of domestic equivalent full-time students for 2020, and that is largely as a result of the Targeted Training and Apprenticeships Fund.
Well done.
What response to the Targeted Training and Apprenticeship Fund has he seen in relationship to Te Ohomai Institute of Technology?
Mr Speaker, there's reportedly been a substantial increase in carpentry and construction courses at Te Hōmai Institute of Technology, with a spokeswoman commenting, "In the past, we've had little interest, and some years this course doesn't run. This year we've had 34 applicants for the 16 available spaces." Mr Speaker, this is good for the trainees, good for the sector, and it's very good for our country's economic recovery.
Question number 10, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Transport, does she stand by all of her statements and policies on road safety?
The Honourable Julianne Ginter.
Speaker, yes, in particular, I stand by this government's record investment in road safety, which in just the past 2 years has already seen $470 million invested in targeted safety improvements to over 2,500 kilometres of state highways. This is already twice what the last government invested over a similar time frame. And I'm happy to report that the New Zealand Transport Agency is on track to have invested close to $1 billion in safety upgrades by the middle of next year.
Why, as of the 1st of June 2020, have only 18 of the promised 198 kilometres of medium barriers on state highways been completed?
Mr Speaker, I think all of us would like to see many more medium barriers rolled out, certainly no one more than I. The New Zealand Transport Agency's progress on medium barriers reflects
order.
That this safety program is a step change compared to what they were doing under the last government, that significant community consultation is required before installing medium barriers, but I can reassure the members on the other side of the House that to speed up the delivery, New Zealand Transport Agency has simplified and standardised the planning process for medium barriers, which will shave 9 to 12 months off their delivery.
The Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Why has she failed to deliver on her press release last December that, and I quote, "a bill to introduce random roadside drug testing will be introduced early in 2020 and prior to the referendum on recreational cannabis use"?
Mr Speaker, I reject the premise of that question, and I can assure the member that this government will be making an announcement very soon.
Supplementary, does she stand by her press statement dated the 18th of December, and I quote, "I will introduce a bill to Parliament early next year to enable oral fluid drug testing to begin in 2021.
Mr Speaker, I'm not sure if that member noticed, but there was an entire shutdown for several months due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And despite this, the government will be making an announcement on the introduction of that bill very soon.
How can she blame COVID for the delays in introducing... How can she blame COVID for the delays in introducing legislation for random roadside drug testing when officials presented her with detailed proposals in November 2017?
Mr Speaker, I understand that it might be hard for the member to understand this, but for several months, the entire government was responding to a COVID-19 pandemic. We had the options, we've worked through, and I'm sure he's going to be very happy to see the bill introduced to the House very soon.
Supplementary.
Michael Wood.
Does she stand by her road safety policies, which have led to a reduction in the road toll every year during which time she has been minister, following on from four consecutive years of increases before she was minister?
Mr Speaker, I can confirm that those numbers are correct. The number of deaths and serious injuries increased year on year from 2013 to 2017 under the last government. They have reduced since then, but I do think that the true benefits of our Road to Zero safety strategy and action plan, which was supported by people right across the sector, local government, police, and the AA and the Road Transport Association, will lead to a sustained reduction in deaths and serious injuries over the next 10 years, and that's how long it takes to achieve that kind of outcome.
Does she stand by her statements on Radio New Zealand in February 2018 that random roadside saliva testing is, quote, too intrusive and, quote, extremely expensive when she rejected officials' proposals? And is that the real reason why she has failed to introduce legislation as promised?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Chris Bishop.
Is it still government policy to make 7,500 kilometres of speed changes by 2021 when the government has delivered just 56 kilometres or 0.74% of that target?
Mr. Speaker, if the member is suddenly expressing his support for huge sweeping changes to speeds on our network, I would certainly support that. But what this government has done and what we always said we would do is take a targeted approach to speed reductions. We have already consulted on 26 speed reviews and there will be more coming. And I look forward to the member's support for that.
Point of order.
Point of order.
I seek leave of the House for the Land Transport Roadside Drug Testing Amendment Bill to be introduced and set down as the first member's order of the day on the next member's day of 29 July.
Is there any objection to that? Yes, there is. Question number 11, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Corrections. Does he stand by his statement regarding community sentences? We expect offenders to complete their hours.
Kelvin Day.
Mr. Speaker, yes, 80% of community sentences are completed, so there is still room for improvement. I also expect my officials to balance attendance against individuals' employment and family responsibilities, as well as other potential barriers such as health concerns or, for example, a global pandemic.
Supplementary. How many offenders sentenced to community service had hours remitted under COVID-19 Alert Level 1, and how many hours were remitted?
Hang on, I'm just going to review that question and contemplate whether it, in fact it flows from the original question. I'll let the member answer it, but I do want to warn members that there has to be a relationship either between the question and the answer and the supplementary, and jumping from a very general statement to a very specific one is not absolutely allowed. Kelvin Davis.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we did have a lockdown that kept people safe from COVID, and Corrections did its part. Now, this member has a very unhealthy fixation on a very few number of people who had traffic fines and the traffic offences and the non-payment of fines.
Order. Can I say to the member, I think suggesting that members have unhealthy fixations in current times is not a good thing to do. Simeon Brown.
Supplementary. Why, when businesses were allowed to open and workers go back to work, was Corrections still remitting hours for offenders sentenced to community service during Level 1, according to Parliamentary Written Question 14424?
Well, again, if Mr. Speaker, if the member had listened to the answer to the primary, I also expect my officials to balance attendance against individuals' employment and family responsibilities, as well as other potential barriers such as health concerns or, for example, the pandemic. And I hear someone over there saying, oh, they broke the law. Mr. Speaker, we're talking about the lowest level of offenders who had traffic offences and the non-payment of fines on the very day that his leader jokes about 29 people escaping from prison under her watch. It goes to show that the National Party has got their priorities wrong, and it's certainly not the party of Kian English anymore.
Here we go, Connor.
What other reports has he received on adherence by offenders to sentences imposed on them?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've seen one report that claims between 2008 and 2011 and in the year 2016 that there were no escapes from prison. I understand that the member in question said her eyebrows were raised, indicating she was joking. So let me be clear, my eyebrows are level. This is just not true. 29 people escaped Corrections custody under that member's watch. The new leader and her false claims are just proving again that the team opposite just ain't what it used to be.
Supplementary. How does the minister stand by his statement, "We expect offenders to complete their hours," when over 138,000 hours have been remitted from the sentences of more than 5,500 offenders, with hours continued to be remitted even under level one while when New Zealanders were going back to work?
Well, again, Mr. Speaker, the corrections deals with 40,000 offenders on any given day. Three quarters of them are dealt with by community corrections. So what this member is talking about over a long period of time, a very small percentage of the offenders, those who had traffic offences and the non-payment of fines, compared to the Leader of the Opposition, who jokes about 29 serious offenders escaping from prison under her watch. She thinks it's a joke. That is not the party of Key and English anymore. They have got their priorities very mixed up.
So is the Minister telling the House that people serving community service sentences shouldn't have to complete their sentences?
No.
Question number 12, Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question's to the Minister for Social Development. What recent announcements has she made about supporting New Zealanders towards financial security?
Mr. Speaker, today Minister Farfoy and I announced the strengthening of debt solution advice and services across New Zealand to combat debt in the wake of COVID-19. This government is putting an additional $4.3 million over 2 years towards two key initiatives. Firstly, we're investing in existing specialist debt solution services. These are qualified experts that our budgeting services can access free of charge to support their clients with more specialised advice on debt restructuring and repayment agreements between debtors and creditors. Secondly, is the expansion of debt consolidation loans for clients who would be able to repay their debts if these were restructured into low-cost or interest-free loans. This government knows that the COVID response and recovery is about responding to people's immediate needs while also planning for the future. That's why we will also be working with stakeholders and communities to develop a comprehensive national debt solution for all New Zealanders.
What difference will this make for families in debt?
Mr. Speaker, this funding is about sheltering indebted individuals and whānau from the financial, health and social impacts of overwhelming debt. For many families, a reason they don't have enough money is that their income is drained by high interest rates, repayments and penalty fees. Well-supported low or no-interest debt consolidation loans are a way to help them out of this trap. We estimate that around 2,000 people will get access to specialist debt support and 1,400 people could get access to and benefit from debt consolidation microfinance loans or help with variations to high-cost loans. Through these initiatives, families will not only be able to have support to address their immediate needs, but will help develop the skill set to enable them to move forward from situations of problem debt and build more prosperous futures.
How does this align with other government work to address problem debt?
Mr. Speaker, today's announcement builds on the $35 million of extra funding for core building financial capability services that I announced recently to address cost pressures for our budgeting services and enable them to increase their capacity as part of the COVID response. In December last year, the government passed the Credit Contracts Legislation Amendment Act, which requires significant improvements to lending practices. Due to COVID, we brought forward the cap on the total amount of repayments, so from the 1st of May this year, anyone who takes out a high-cost loan never has to repay more than twice what they have borrowed. We've also put in place regulations for all mobile traders and truck shops, including ensuring they assess affordability before agreeing to sell goods or credit on credit. This government is investing in the well-being of our people and communities in the wake of COVID-19 and putting in place our plan for a strong and stable future for New Zealand.
That concludes oral questions.